great the great pleasure this evening of welcoming the poet laureate of Vermont, Sid Lee, to be able to do a bit of reading for us. Sid is very clearly the most appropriate guy to bring into an event like this. He's been characterized as it's not clear whether you characterize him as a woodsman who writes or a writer who spends all of his time in the woods. But regardless, he is one of the greatest representatives of what we try to do in conserving property for the Upper Valley Land Trust. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Poet Laureate of Vermont, Sid Lee.
I'm going to turn this around because I like the pace a bit for whatever reason. When I found out that I was Poet Laureate of Vermont, I was corrected by my youngest daughter, who said that that's pronounced low rate. I didn't have 40 seconds of gloating before. though that's my recent distinction, by which I am more gratified than I ever imagined I would be, I'm actually not going to read poetry tonight. Now, I don't know if that occasions tomatoes or relief, but it happens that well before I was designated the Poet Laureate of Vermont, I had completed a book which somehow seemed more appropriate for a gathering like this, on which more in a moment. What it is, to some extent, almost an allegory, I think, of what I find so valuable in the Upper Valley Land Trust, and the Land Trust movement in general, strikes me as the future of conservation in this country. Without the efforts of the Upper Valley Land Trust and its staff and its supporters, of which I've been one since that smart little girl, even before that smart little girl, Jeannie McIntyre, came on.
That was a long time ago.
and without those efforts, we have fewer and fewer experiences of the sort that I mean to render here. The Upper Valley Land Trust in this neck of the woods, and I was astonished to see all those little green dots. I knew a lot of very good work had been done by this organization, but I was astonished to see how many little green dots there were on that map. And red ones, which will soon turn green, and delighted. But it's not only an important organization, it seems to me, but it's really a vital one. The bridges that it builds between landowners, community people, and Aldo Leopold's land ethic are bridges to a sustainable world. This reading constitutes a chapter from a forthcoming book, which is called Now Look. And you needn't know why until you buy the book, which I'm sure you all do. And it focuses mostly on Upper New England old-timers who so deeply affected my life and my work. Many of them are not from Vermont or New Hampshire. Many of them are from Maine, from a part of the world that Peter Stein knows well, because thanks to Lon Timber's efforts, we're working on conserving even more of that part of the world than we already have. And that amounts to about 345,000 acres, to which we mean add 22,000 that Lon Timber now owns, and was gracious and insightful enough to give us an opportunity to buy up, first by way of two phases of development rights, and then to own outright. But in any case, if I catalog some names here, just understand that in the larger context of the book, their identities are pretty clear. For tonight, if you hear any name in its vacuum, you can just think, old Yankee. This is an essay, Ben, what I like to call a lyrical essay. You know, this term creative nonfiction has gotten abroad, and I just, every time I hear it, I go to the shower to avoid suicide. I find it an unwieldy term, so I like to think that it means it's lyrical or personal essays. This one is called Snow Dust.
Mid-morning yesterday, in an unusually cold and lowery March, I kissed my wife a temporary goodbye, where she always follows the trail uphill to complete the loop, as we call it. I was lately retired, so she was busier than I. Her yen for quick exercise displaying urgency I needn't share. She was busier and a lot faster. We're essentially of identical height, but her 36-inch inseams, compared to my stubby 31, floats her willowy frame ahead of me at speed to give me a workout before my workout begins. I stood a moment to watch her, as ever, a glory in my eyes as she practically lopes uphill. When we embraced, she smelled of cold, fresh air, a scent I love. For her part, she loves repetition, following the loop every day, savoring its matchless view of Moose Bluff to our east, her trails every hollow and ledge familiar. I prefer improvisation, habitually getting off trail as soon as I head out on a ramble, especially during a good winter for snow, like this past one, when I could pass over the buried brush rather than fighting through it, as I must in warmer months. I like that wide whiteness under the canopy, inscribed only by the movements of wild things whose doings have provided a lifelong fascination. It wasn't long yesterday morning, in fact, before I came on a clear and perfect narrative. The twin stabs of the fissure exploding into a ragged hole in snow, around which the delicate rusts and grays of grouse feathers and a few little umlauts of blood showed vivid. The bird must have been resting under powder and couldn't burst out in time to avoid the predator. There's always something to read out there. So said Donald Chambers, beloved old woodsman and mentor, and no one has said it better since. Don's words come back from 50 years ago when I watched him, short fire plug of a man, making his pronouncement, then sniffing and thumbing his glasses back up his pug nose, his curious habit after passing judgments, which tended to the sage and the benign. Carrying a pail of water or feed, he lifted it no more than a 16th of an inch. I'm sorry, I missed the paragraph. My wife would kill me. Stay with these things, will you? Don had an efficiency about him that I always marveled at, vowed to imitate, and by temperament simply couldn't. He wouldn't have understood my urge to meander the way I did yesterday. If there was a place to walk to, you went directly from here to there. Carrying a pail of water or feed, you lifted it no more than a 16th of an inch over any rock or hummock in your way. Why waste energy? Efficiency and deliberation, a quality I've also too often lacked. I once brought Don a wind-up clock to which I'd lost the key, for example, and he sat for hours on end with a ball peen hammer, a flat file, and one brass screw, until in time he fashioned something workable, as it remains to this day. A fellow could cry, I thought. But how in the first place had a fellow gotten here from a tumult of animal sign and snow? He'd certainly taken no unswerving path. The mystery wasn't so deep, though, since my mind is never a model of efficiency. There are certain places and people to which it seems almost automatically and directly to go, to be sure, if I leave it alone, as I try to do on these treks, but then it'll be off to who can say. There were also living people who called to me as I read the drama of Grouse and Fisher. Next week, my brother-in-law would have yet another test for cancer. The doctors would check his brain for tumors, as if the colon variety hadn't been enough, and the lung surgery to excise his migratory cells. This was a man I loved like blood family. Oh, there seemed enough worry to hold me and others for sure. His mother, a lovely, valiant woman, a living mockery of every stupid mother-in-law joke ever uttered, had fallen the day before out in Colorado. She'd been staying with her youngest daughter, happily the one who's a nurse. The tumble caused a mild concussion, but diagnostics revealed something worse. A spine so compromised by osteoporosis as to make it almost indistinguishable from the surrounding soft tissue. This was a woman vigorous enough 10 years back to hike and paddle with people considerably for a junior. slightly more than a decade myself, I was still able to snowshoe through these 2 feet of powder and hump my considerable frame along for most of the day after bird dogs found enough to wade a fairly bossy trout stream. I was nonetheless subject, for all my denials and exertions, to the same penalties of time as she. Whom would I be fooling to think otherwise? I began to mope a little, even though I wondered the mulish aspect of my nature that obliges me to give myself little sermons on my own good fortune. A better man than saner would, of course, have looked at my in-law's health problems from a better and saner perspective. My wife's brother had barely reached age 50, and he was in a genuine mess. I knew he'd have given all his teeth to be in my snowshoes instead. My mother-in-law would have been grateful for a quarter hour of what I had in amplitude. My better self knew this, and yet the hike I'd planned up and over Barnet Knoll and down to an overgrown push road to the west felt slightly like a plod now. That old demon, what's the use, my understated companion. So many of my dearest friends and relatives gone or threatened, and I in what has to be acknowledged as the home stretch. This hiking was hard. Someone of my bulk, snowshoes I know, must post-hole it through such deep powder, and again, no matter my denials, I couldn't do that as I pushed 70, even as well as I did pushing 60. I suddenly felt a tart anger at that, but an equal one at my own improvidence. In autumn, I'd gone to the internet, as best a techno-Neanderthal like me could manage, to find a set of longer trail shoes than any locally available ones. I needed them for just such a day as this. My 36 inches weren't giving me the flotation I needed, and my incipiently stenotic lower back kept complaining about the matter. I'd marked down several brands and designs, any of which would have served me better than what I wore. Maybe something in me recoiled from mixing cyberspace with the space I'd travel on foot. In any case, I didn't follow through. I swore I'd see to things that very afternoon. When I finally crested Barnet Knoll, I shut off my petty whining for a bit to marvel again at wild sign. There were scores of deer cuffings in the red oak stand there. As always, the life force of the untamed creatures awed me. What skill and ardor went into finding and digging up those acorns? Every single day, the whitetails needed to find some way to make it through, to discover adequate nourishment, and so did their stalkers. The evergreen tips around a nearby frozen patch of wetland had been trimmed as high as the deer could stand on hind legs. A pileated woodpecker had showered a pile of square-wrought chips from a hemlock. They flashed like sequins, even beneath an overcast sky. A little further on, the softwoods grew higher and their tops mingled more densely, and whether or not I found them, I knew the tiny golden-crowned kinglets would be busy there, flitting from one tree to another, looking among the shingled cones for enough larvae and grubs, many times their body weight, to see them through another day and night. All this did chasten me, though too mildly. I didn't really know and never had what struggle was, at least in its elemental shape, having been so lucky a man in my family, my career, my friends, and my health. And yet I kept coming back against my will to a notion of creaturely existence as a persistent scuffle and inevitably a losing one. To go looking for the kinglets, which I had been blessed to see 10 or 12 times, another token of my enviable fortune, struck me less as motive for the time being than habit. To ratify the pessimistic view, I needed no more than 20 further paces to come across another story in snow. A winter-killed deer, everything gone but a patch or two of hide, a thigh bone, and a lower jaw with teeth ripped out. What little the coyotes and fishers had left was finished off by the ravens and rodents. The previous night's light snow had sugared all the trees. Now another shower was floating down. To shove through the thick growth ahead would be to dislodge powder from above with every step. Since, bald though I am, I seldom wear a hat, soon enough, I'd be feeling the cold stuff direct. I almost short-circuited the hike, but instead, perhaps more in debt to habit than even I had realized, I cinch my jacket collar, inwardly whining about one more small misery to endure. Misery? Endure? Good God? Thank heaven the realistic view kept deluding my self-pity. I too often heard fellow higher academics protest how difficult their lives and work were, and as often silently thought they might try cleaning roadkill from a Mississippi highway in summer, say, or tending the lavatories in a hospital for the criminally insane, or simply teaching bubbly high school. And yet here I've just been grouching myself that I'd soon have to face a bath of clean snow. For all of that, something perversely gloomy kept tugging at me like a horse at its tether. There were fairly open woods on the western side hill before I reached the grander forest. It was midday now, and to my south, a winter sun, the color of a Eucharist wafer, glimmered through the cloud cover. I had to concede that the cascade of flakes across its face looked lovely. And thus distracted, I shoulder brushed the skinny fur, which did prematurely drop a feathery spill on the head and neck. I cursed by instinct, then right away beheld how the finer flakes hovered around me like a nimbus, that pale sun seeping through it, a net of stars. In that instant, my region's genius, Robert Frost, sprang to mind. Dust of snow. The way a crow shook down on me, the dust of snow from a hemlock tree, has given my heart a change of mood and saved some part of a day I had rued. I hadn't seen Frost's crow, but even though I had been the one to shake down snow dust, my day, which, yes, had gone slightly and inappropriately rueful, turned. It was as though I instantly saw the full privilege of my life. The dust of snow seemed some magical powder mixed by figures from old fairy tales to induce visions of peace and rest. I could have sworn I heard a voice, my own, a breeze's, some god's, preaching calm. As so often, a moment also summoned others like it. I thought back to a morning on the flank of Kenyon Hill in line just above our yellow house, when my son, now 39 and twice a father himself, touched the back of my neck from his riding pack in a way so delicate it almost brought on tears. It was only two and just the side of sleep, but I still feel the fuzzy stroke of a mitten under my ear. I stopped then and stood gazing at the house through an identical scrim of snow and felt the sort of peace that comes on a person, if he's lucky, more than once in a lifetime. It had come on me more often than I could reckon, unearned, a sort of grace. To recall that boy on my back was to drift on to each of his four siblings, my oldest daughter, thanking me for removing my own mittens, reaching up to clasp her hands, gone cold enough to pain her. Miraculously, she told me, "I love your fingers. They're always nice and warm." Well, I had doubts about my own inner warmth, certain of my adolescent demons still rampant in my soul. But from this other trail, a similar snow zigzagging ever so softly through the treetops below what locals call the hedgehog den, they were blessedly absent. When he was three or four, I often hiked my younger son in the same pack to another place, where he'd shoot with his play bow and imagine game, which he somehow imagined as caribou. The spot was just an old log landing, but we named it Caribou Country. Once, after he took a score or so of shots in Caribou Country, I hefted him again, turned onto the downhill route homeward, and began jogging in a way that knees and back would prohibit the day. Singing a song that began, "I bought a mule, he's such a fool that he never paid no heed." I'd learned the song from one of the elder woodsmen who so shaped my life. As I write this, I see Creston MacArthur inside his lakeside camp, having swallowed a belt or two of something amber, veins pushing out in his neck as he chants the refrain, "Go low, mule, don't you roll them eyes, you can change a fool, but a gall dang mule, I'm a mule until he dies." Well, the lake is buckling outdoors, and it's getting on mid-March like the day. The stove glows crimson, warming the place so that ice dams thaw and drip from the eaves. There's that smell of must and man and wood fire I'll always treasure. I'd be the fool to wish myself anywhere else. On a later day, I recalled my second son sang that tune with me for perhaps 60 feet. Then he stopped mid-breath even before we got to the refrain. I slowed to a walk, recognizing that he was deep in slumber,
which likely meant he dropped his small plastic bow behind us. Without checking, I hiked a little way back, and sure enough, there it lay, glowing red as an exhausted star in the snow. I stooped and fetched the puny weapon that looked out across the valley from Stonehouse Mount. Everything so beautiful. Why hadn't I been noticing this right along? Same snow, same peace, same sense of possibility and gratitude. And I couldn't stop now. I thought back to the middle daughter as we descended another flank of the same mountain, her warmth piercing through the back and my two layers of clothing. She'd been sleeping almost from the moment we left the house, yet all along had been so profoundly there. Below me, under a gnarled and woodpecker-ravaged beech tree, my bird dog Bessie stood stock still, as if she pointed some phantom woodcock. But no, she was merely gazing at her master, who stood still, too, in that long moment, mumbling something related to Hosanna, amazed not least that so noble an animal was less concerned with him, of all people. And finally, almost 20 years gone now, the last child, my namesake, a little late, removing her glove and waving her pudgy fist through the same peaceful flurry, chanting a little Knox ditty whose words I've forgotten. But words weren't the main thing here. Sometimes they aren't. I stooped to pluck the mitten from adrift and slipped it back on. Finally, and all this I suspect in less than a minute, I went back even farther in time to a solo descent of Demick Hill, where snowshoe hare, white as flakes themselves, kept flitting back and forth across the ancient logging road I followed. That they should keep bursting out of the brush like that. Well, it seemed apparitional, as by God it was. Hosanna indeed. My self-preoccupation, whenever it rears its ugly head, is unforgivable. It will always be a mystery to me why I must feel my way out of such funk, or more specifically, remember my way out. At too long last, both the benisons of my present life and older ones too will at length prevail over sorrow at natural loss. That the last of our children was out of the house now must surely have had something to do with this vague inner sorrow I took into the woods yesterday. And yet surely the most important aspect of my part in raising all five involved their capacity to distract me from me. If I ever complained, and what parent doesn't, about the frequent chorishness of parenting, I knew deep inside that the end validated the busy work, that in fact it wasn't busy work at all. And the moments I'd recalled in winter and snow, children on my back, both literally and metaphorically, would sustain me if nothing else did, if I could only be moved despite myself to summon them, just as I'd lately done on Barnett Knoll. All it took was a little snow. Standing there a day ago, I knew that a warm house awaited, but I lingered, looking up now, willy-nilly, to see Earl Bonus ahead of me, wearing the elegant snowshoes he'd brought in that little red shop of his. Earl was a man who knew pain much more than most of us ever do, and certainly more than I. It was a sudden, incomprehensible death of his daughter at 16, dropped to the floor in the middle of a basketball game. His courageous younger son, Alan, cursed with cystic fibrosis, worked himself literally off his feet, determined to do a job right, tumbling behind a pushed lawnmower, collapsing under an armful of stove wood until he finally fell for good in his early 40s. And there was the catastrophic death by gunshot of his grandson, Tommy, which Earl insisted until his own death was no suicide, but was after all still death. A boy whom he and his wife, Techie, had raised. There was their contemplation of that grandson's father. For years he wrestled his demons after coming back from Vietnam. His wife long since spooked and fled. Earl wore pain on his face and in his matchless basso voice, but he never went further in my company than to say, memories can bear down on you. Indeed, they can. But they can buoy as well, as in mind I scan from Earl to Donald, from Donald to George, from George to Creston, from Creston to Carter, from Carter to Annie, from Annie to Ada, and on, beholding their faces with an inner eye, a kind of enlightenment fell on me like the snow I'd lately jostled. What was it I'd so treasured in each and all? The capacity, precisely, to joy in how and where and what they lived.
Most had known hard times and hard work that I couldn't conceive. But they were sturdy, or even often jolly, which was to say they all valued their lives on life's terms. I heard the voice of George just then after I asked him how he'd stood the crushing labor of his young manhood, making railroad ties with a broadaxe out by lantern in the morning, back the same way at night. You took pride in your work, he answered. And if you couldn't fix something, you let it be. My principal labor was a luxury, even an embarrassment compared. It was no more than the ongoing effort truly to reckon what a bounty this life, both active and reflective, had offered, and then to write down as much of it as I could. I thought, you better hope he can change a fool. All this from a small, bright dust of snow. I had to hike a little more strenuously than I'd forecast, breaking trail to where I stood in reminiscence. Even I knew it might be more than I'd bargained for to pursue the route I originally intended. To hell with pride, I decided, swinging south, homeward, snaking through the woods as best I could, helped on my way by the long decline. In a quarter of an hour or so, I stepped onto a white space that stretched west-east out of sight. I gaped, having thought in decades of searching through these hundreds of ambient acres that I knew their every inch. Yet here I was on an old tote road I'd never seen. Had I missed it in the warm months because vegetation grew thick across it? I didn't think so. Years of bushwhacking had made me pretty adept at tracing trails that others might not notice. I knew which way the house lay. I wasn't lost, not even as those old woodsmen said, turned around. But everything in every direction looked brand new to me. The untouched belt of snow, a palette for memory and imagination both. And without a tiny dash of olive gray in my eye's corner and the almost equally tiny gap between two tall spruces, had my kinglets come? Had I been here before or not? And what did here mean anymore? This surely seemed a new path, and its untouched whiteness provided the old inducement to walk it in one direction or the other. If there were literal geographical places in my own backwoods that I hadn't explored, what other source of exploration had I failed to make? Yes, I could head either way and see what was what. Neither way pointing home, though, I'd marked that ghost road in mind, saving it for a later day. That's the end.